Space. The final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no one has gone before.
And those are the words of Captain Christopher Pike in a new Star Trek show called Strange New Worlds. This latest incarnation of Star Trek goes back to the roots of the 56-year-old science fiction saga, but it also updates the science and the social dynamics for the 23rd century of our imagination and for the 21st century of our reality. In a new book titled Phasers on Stun, Ryan Britt chronicles what's changed about Star Trek and what's stayed the same. Greetings, Earthlings. I'm Alan Boyle, one of your hosts for the Fiction Science Podcast, coming to you from the place where science and technology intersect with fiction and popular culture. Join me and my co-host, science fiction author Dominica Fedeplace, as we talk with Ryan Britt about the impact that Star Trek has had on real-life space exploration and how the past 5 decades have changed the fictional final frontier. Back in the late 60s, the TV show known as Star Trek was a trailblazer for primetime science fiction, as well as for social change. For example, Star Trek is credited with airing the first interracial kiss to be shown on TV. In his new book, Phasers on Stun, Ryan Britt focuses on the behind-the-scenes history of the Star Trek franchise, which takes in more than 24 movies and TV shows. But as you'll find out in this podcast, he also knows his way around the science of Star Trek, including its updated depictions of black holes and the challenges of communicating with aliens. Ryan is the entertainment editor for Fatherly and a contributing writer for Inverse. He's written about science fiction sagas ranging from Blade Runner to Star Wars and Dune, but Star Trek is his specialty. Dominica Fedeplace and I could not resist geeking out with Ryan for more than an hour on Zoom. And I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we did. We started out by asking Ryan how he decided to take on the task of documenting Star Trek's half century of history and how long it took to write the book.
The answer to how long it took is like it either took like 2 years, right, from selling the book to the book coming out, or it took like 38 years, you know, because I'm 40, you know, and I've been a Star Trek fan since I was 6, you know what I mean? So it kind of depends on how you look at when was I writing the book in my head versus, you know, when was I writing this particular book. So this particular book took 2 years. There's been a lot of nonfiction Star Trek books, as you're both probably aware. I wanted to do a book, though, that I had never quite seen, which was to treat Star Trek as though someone had perhaps never really heard of it didn't know perhaps a lot of the amazing sort of behind the scenes stories that had become kind of baked into the mythology, and sort of present it in the same way you see those like new books about like the Beatles or something. And it just is like, you know what, this belongs to every generation, and I am younger. I'm 40, but I am young. I'll be 41 in a couple months. I'm younger than a lot of the journalists who sort of have traditionally covered it. And so my thinking was like, okay, let's do this from my generation's point of view, or specifically my point of view, because as a white male, obviously I have my own point of view, and that is not necessarily the totality of Star Trek, obviously. So then the goal is to like mitigate that, right? And to get as many voices as you can in the mix to sort of like help you understand what Star Trek means to them. So the research process took a lot longer than I expected, even though I already knew a lot about Star Trek. So I would say the research perhaps took longer than the writing, maybe. But that's part of the writing, I guess.
Yeah, the subtitle of the book is How the Making and Remaking of Star Trek Changed the World. And so at the risk of sharing a spoiler of Mirror Universe proportions, how did Star Trek change the world?
Well, I think that it changed the world first, and this is something that is perhaps not as earth-shattering as you might think, is that it was the first continuing science fiction show with recurring characters that had continuity for adults. Just simply that it was for adults. You had the Twilight Zone and the Outer Limits, but those characters didn't carry over. You had Lost in Space, but that was aimed at children. Doctor Who also started as a children's show. There was never a science fiction show that was for adults. So with that then came a platform to discuss all sorts of things that science fiction had already been kind of discussing in print, but never really on the scale of a television audience, which allowed for a lot more eyeballs. Norman Spinrad, who is a science fiction writer who wrote the Doomsday Machine of the original series, and this is in the book, said that he considered the original Star Trek similar to when Bob Dylan went electric. Like, that is what it did for science fiction, is that it really brought it into the mainstream. And so then that creates a lot of interesting political social events. And so then you can start to pick things out about how there was a lot of multicultural representation on the original series, and that was groundbreaking. And then that affected how, you know, Martin Luther King then kept, you know, asked Nichelle Nichols to stay on the show. And then Nichelle Nichols recruits the first Black and female astronauts to the space program. And then Barack Obama is a Star Trek fan, and that affects his personality. And, you know, so then all of these things sort of start to spiderweb out because of the platform, and because science fiction was a platform that Roddenberry believed could be utilized to tell sort of socially important stories in other ways. And then, you know, the people that have subsequently written Star Trek after him have, you know, kept going with that for the most part.
Yeah, in the book, you really emphasize the cultural and even the political dimensions of the Star Trek saga. But I'm really curious whether Star Trek is still capable of changing the world in the way it did in this weird era that we're going through now. It seems as if this is almost a non-Star Trek era in which the show's vision of diversity and acceptance and long-term optimism, that vision seems farther away than ever.
It does, but it's odd because Star Trek oddly predicted that things were going to get bad before they got better, you know, and that we're actually like, it's kind of eerie because, you know, in the original series, it was always like, oh, in the early 21st century, the Earth just almost destroyed themselves, but then they got out of it. And then so in the Star Trek history, we're still not there. We're still kind of in the bad period. But one thing that Star Trek has always been good at is, even if the science contained in Star Trek is a little bit invented, is a little bit fictional, the science is still generally the solution. So you even saw this in like the most recent season of Star Trek Discovery, where they had, for the first time that Star Trek has ever really done, they had an alien species that they just could not communicate with. And I'm not talking for like one episode. I'm talking for like 9 episodes. They're just like, we cannot figure out how to communicate. And the reason why was because they decided to embrace a little bit more hard science on what communicating with aliens would actually be like. And that there are a lot of other, other than auditory communication, there's a lot of other options available when we think about what life could be like. And this was an extragalactic life form, right? So then they find out that it ends up being like these kind of these pheromones, sort of, that it communicates through these sort of feelings and these emotions, and those are represented by it. They can translate that back into math, and then they can go from there and sort of create a bridge language, and all of that stuff is very much in the nitty-gritty of imagining how to bridge communication gaps. But the message contained in that is really interesting, right? Because sometimes it feels like there's not a common language, you know, between all of us here on Earth. And sometimes I think the most useful Star Trek technology that we could ever have would be the universal translator, right? Like mm-hmm. the ability to instantly understand someone in their language. Like, don't you think that would decrease, you know?
Yeah, and we're getting there, actually, you know, like, with Google Translate. We're right. getting close right. to that. That's fascinating that Star Trek in its latest incarnation has picked up on some of the latest research relating to the idea of communication or the challenge to communicating with extraterrestrial civilizations. Are there other examples? I know in the book you tried to focus on the cultural phenomenon rather than the scientific and technological background, but Are there ways that Star Trek has updated its scientific universe because of what's been discovered in the last 50 years?
Sure. You really have to credit someone named Aaron McDonald on that, who is the science advisor for the contemporary Star Trek shows. So an Aaron McDonald would be the person who like advises all the Paramount CBS shows. So that Star Trek Discovery, that Star Trek Lower Decks, that Star Trek Picard, Star Trek Strange New Worlds, Star Trek Prodigy. But yeah, I mean, like a recent episode of Strange New Worlds, you know, had the Enterprise getting as close as they could to an actual black hole. And the way that they've depicted the black holes in the contemporary Star Treks, starting in Discovery Season 2, and now is very close to how contemporary science thinks that they would look and behave. And so in the original series, you know, sometimes Kirk would throw out like what a quasar is and it wasn't quite right. But now it's very close in terms of like the way the spatial phenomena look in the new shows is very cutting edge. And in fairness, Star Trek has always tried to do that, right? Like it wasn't, but they always, like in the 60s show, Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, was consulting with the RAND Corporation to try to make sure that these things were as close as possible. In the 80s and 90s shows, The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, you know, hired science consultants and those kinds of things. You know, there's a great photograph of Gene Roddenberry and DeForest Kelly, who played Bones, and James Doohan, who played Scotty, like at NASA around a Voyager probe. There's always been a tradition there, but yeah, the contemporary shows have Aaron McDonald, who is just a really interesting person and a brilliant science expert. Even on the comedy show Lower Decks, which is a shirt that I'm wearing, they will check some of the spatial phenomena that they're allowed to depict and whether or not they can swing it within a science that is known.
Do you have an example of that? I'm really interested.
There was again, this would be like the domain of Aaron McDonald, but there would be the example would be, again, it's like a grazing a quasar situation, which I believe is in the episode I Excretus, in which the USS Cerritos tries to intentionally sort of graze a quasar to sort of freak out this person that's aboard that they're kind of trying to mess with. Yeah, and I might have the detail of that wrong, but I do know that that show has a lot of spatial phenomena that need to be as accurate as they can within the kind of Star Trek realm of things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, they have, you know, they depict zero gravity in that series. I can't remember which episode it is, but that the episode begins with the characters get accidentally stranded in their spacesuits on top of, like, while repairing a space satellite. And then it's like 5 hours later, they're like shivering. And it's like, that's how it would be. You know, they would be close to death. You know, they would need to then be resuscitated. So yeah, they're, even the new shows that are like comedies, they care, I guess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And you mentioned how Gene Roddenberry worked with RAND. I've always wondered about plot points like warp drives and teleportation and compact communicators. A lot of people talk about how Star Trek was predictive in that way. And I've always wondered whether it was just something that Gene and the writers of Star Trek used as convenient plot devices. If you transport somebody down to the surface of a planet, you don't have to take the time of actually getting them there on a spacecraft. Or did they really base it on scientific concepts that were in the air at that time?
Well, I think that it's a little bit of both, but I think that you are right in that it was a storytelling first, right? What do we need for the storytelling? So with the original series and beaming the transporter, right? That was definitely something that was created to save money. And Roddenberry said that many times. He says it in the earliest behind the scenes Star Trek book, which is called The Making of Star Trek, which came out in 1968, of which he is a co-author. And he says that we did that so we wouldn't have to land the spaceship every week. So then it's like they need something to make the fiction work. So then they go back. So then they try to make that as plausible as possible. So then I think that's where you get the communicators. Phasers were called phasers because Roddenberry knew that calling it a laser would make it sound outdated. Now, that isn't to say that the phaser phased energy was based on a real concept. He was just trying to make something that didn't sound ridiculous, right? Because he knew if in the cage, Captain Pike, the pilot of Star Trek that wasn't used, Captain Pike is still rocking a laser pistol. And the RAND Corporation was like, this is going to be, you're going to look dumb Like people like lasers don't do that. Don't say laser. And so that's a small example of like where it's kind of like splitting the difference. It wasn't so much what Star Trek did do in terms of representing real science, but what it avoided doing with like kind of bad science from other science fiction. There's no flames coming out of the back of the Enterprise. That was like a no way. We're never doing that. Things like that. The Enterprise was not a rocket ship. So I think that that's where you can kind of see it. But then, you know, like when you get to the 70s, you've got Jesco von Puttkamer, who was a NASA guy, who was an advisor on Star Trek, the motion picture. And that's the first time you have a wormhole being depicted in a major science fiction movie. And that was at the suggestion, right? So some of it comes from the science side and some of it comes from the fiction side.
One of the things I really enjoyed about this book was all the interviews you conduct with writers and producers and stars. What was it like as a lifelong fan getting to talk to all these legends?
Well, it was great. I can never overstate how great it is to talk to some of the big Star Trek names, you know what I mean? And what a thrill it is. That said, is I have been an entertainment journalist for a little while. It is something that you have to get over, right? When you interview somebody, because otherwise you can't do your job. So sometimes it would almost hit me after the fact. My favorite example of this is that I interviewed for the book and also for an article I was writing. I interviewed LeVar Burton and Brent Spiner on the same day. But in between interviewing them, I interviewed LeVar in the morning. I got my COVID booster shot. This was in 2021. April of 2021, I got my COVID booster shot. And then in the afternoon, I interviewed Brent Spiner. And then I went to my couch and collapsed. And my daughter, who was turning 4 at the time, sort of climbed on top of me. There's this picture of me. And I'm not just exhausted from my COVID booster, because I was, but I was also exhausted from being like, oh my God, I just interviewed Geordi LaForge and Data in the same day. So that was a big day.
You also mentioned the book, you got a call from Paramount at one point because you were posting some speculation about a series that veered too close to a spoiler. Could you tell us about what that was like?
Yeah, so it was still, so Paramount is now remerged with CBS. So now it is Paramount. But in 2017, when Star Trek Discovery was first airing, it was still CBS, right? And so, yeah, I got just a voicemail that was like, you know, this is a, you'd please call us back. You know, we're filming some Star Trek right now, but please call us back. And I had just written about, I wasn't the first fan to do this. I wrote for Inverse then. I do still write for Inverse now. I was just doing, you know, what we call in the business, you know, fan theories. You know, when you're a entertainment journalist, sometimes you get to be a professional fan theorist. And those, you know, do great because people love trying to figure out what's going on a show, not just Star Trek. You know, we know this, people love doing this. But yeah, I had just put some pieces together about Jason Isaacs' character, Captain Lorca, and whether or not he was or was not from the Mirror Universe. And he was. And so they were just like, we're trying to keep this a secret. Could you maybe walk back your speculation? And I was like, I will, but you have to let me talk to more cast members of your show. And then they did. And it's been a wonderful relationship.
It must have been so fun to have called it, though.
Yeah, it was. I mean, now I tend to see a lot. I'm usually like 5 or 6 episodes ahead. So like now, I don't know, are you guys watching Strange New Worlds?
Yes.
Okay, well, yeah. So I'm like, I just got the finale in my inbox. So,
yikes.
You know, like, so I'm like way ahead. And so I have to be careful. And like with Picard, you know, like journalists got some of those like really ahead, like a month or two. You know, so then you kind of have to sit on it and be like, oh, okay, you know. So I do less fan theories for Star Trek now because I kind of, I'm a little bit more of a professional journalist now than I was then. But it helped kind of catapult me. You know, I kind of gate crashed it a little bit.
Do you have any desire to go back to those posts where you called it and restore them so that you could point to them and say, I got it right?
No, because I think that I'd much rather be known for some interesting observation that I've made about a deeper meaning of something than sort of a literal connecting A to B. I'm good at that too. You know what I mean? Like I can do that too, where I can say this, the reason why this happened in this episode is it connects, you know, a domino falling. But I think that my I'm more interested in things that last, that are less ephemeral, you know, which is also kind of the motivation for writing the book, because you write things online and they are a little bit ephemeral. So if I get to interview, I was one of the first journalists to interview Ethan Peck as Spock for Discovery season 2. But then, you know, you only get to use a little bit of the interview and what gets published. And then there's another editor involved. And, you know, then you've got this whole conversation that you had with this wonderful person. And then you're like, well, what else can I do with this? So it's not so ephemeral. So it doesn't just become a Google result that sort of goes away. And so I had a lot of that with the contemporary Star Trek shows. And I wanted to, have it be a little bit more meaningful and have it live on, you know? Mm-hmm.
Well, I write for a Seattle-based tech site called GeekWire, and I've had many occasions to refer to the connections between Star Trek and Jeff Bezos, including Jeff's cameo role in Star Trek Beyond, William Shatner's flight on Blue Origin's New Shepard spacecraft, and the fact that Star Trek's talking computer may have inspired Amazon's Alexa. Do you have any observations or stories to share about Jeff Bezos and Star Trek?
Only that I interviewed William Shatner after he went to space because of Jeff Bezos. I can't imagine a version of the world where Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos exist, for better or worse, however you feel about them, without Star Trek. And I'm not saying that those guys embody all of Star Trek's ideals, because they may not. But there is an audacity to space travel, whether it is from a government like NASA or another nation's government that's sort of putting people into space, or if it's from a private sector, right? I don't know if you watch a show For All Mankind, the Apple
yes,
TV show.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
So are you watching the new season where they have?
I am.
Mm-hmm. So they have Dev, right? Who is the kind of cipher for in For All Mankind. They have an alternate version of the 1990s where there's this space company called Helios, and this guy, he says, we want to go where no man has gone before, right? And what I love about that is Ronald D. Moore is a co-creator.
Exactly, a former Trek writer.
Big Trek writer, right? And so Ronald D. Moore, and I've interviewed Ronald D. Moore about For All Mankind, and I've asked him, like, does Star Trek still influence the space program, you know, in this alternate dimension? He's like, oh, even more so. You know, Star Trek's even, his contention is that Star Trek is even more successful in the 70s in the For All Mankind universe, which is connected to why space travel is so much more popular. But I love that kind of bit of sort of mental gymnastics, right? Because there is a connection. This is a roundabout way of answering the Bezos question, is like, yes, there's a connection between that idea to do sort of private space travel and the sort of boldness of Star Trek. And so I don't think that you have those kinds of things without it.
And it's interesting that Elon Musk got a shout out in an episode of Star Trek Discovery, ironically by Captain Lorca, who is the secret villain.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I've pointed that out to a lot of fans, because a lot of people like have taken umbrage to that. They're like, oh, they were saying that. And I was like, well, everything that Captain Lorca was saying was from the Mirror Universe. So I made a joke that, you know, in the Mirror Universe, they use all the flamethrowers that Elon Musk manufactured, you know? But yeah, I actually think that reference was fine, because it also helped to sort of like say that there were these less than perfect individuals that were space pioneers, because he also mentioned Zefram Cochrane, who, as we know in the Star Trek world, invents warp drive. But like First Contact, written by Ronald D. Moore, co-written with Brandon Braga, was this great film that demonstrated, hey, this guy who invented warp drive was kind of a drunk, you know, and he was not necessarily a great person. And I always thought that was such a smart way of sort of recasting everything about Star Trek, because it wasn't necessarily letting him off the hook, but it was saying these things that happen when humanity leaps forward are not always going to be without their drawbacks, let's say. You know, and I always thought that was also a secret commentary on Gene Roddenberry himself, oddly. I thought that was like a way of saying, like, the person that created this will be sort of deified, but here they are when they're actually in the trenches building it, and there's messiness. I like that Star Trek is willing to do that.
I think that the idea of private space efforts and billionaires, or maybe in the 23rd century, trillionaires being involved in their own space effort, it seems to me that that's something that maybe Gene Roddenberry perhaps didn't think about because it wasn't happening back then. But it seems to me that as Star Trek goes forward, I've got to think that would be a new frontier for Star Trek, is to explore that idea of private individuals involved in spaceflight. And another angle that I thought would be really interesting just from current society is this whole idea of disinformation. I don't know if Star Trek addressed that issue of disinformation and the big lie and that sort of thing in past incarnations, but it seems to me that that's a big one to explore if you're talking about cultural dimensions to the Star Trek saga.
Well, one of the most popular episodes of Deep Space Nine is In the Pale Moonlight, and that's an episode where Captain Sisko considers manufacturing false holographic evidence that something has occurred in order to sort of get a political sort of alliance to work with the Romulans.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Right. And so that's often cited as one of the best episodes of Deep Space Nine. And people that are, you know, if Deep Space Nine is your favorite Star Trek show, it's also possible that In the Pale Moonlight is like your favorite Star Trek episode.
That would be Deep Fake Nine.
Right. Deep Fake. Right. But that's what they're doing, right? Like he and Garak, Sisko conspires with Garak, who is a spy, former spy for the Cardassians, to create a deep fake essentially that will convince the Romulans to kind of do something. And then, and he's like, and it's just like, he just keeps thinking about like the bottom line about how many lives it's going to save, but he's still creating fake news. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that what Star Trek always does is it always like spins it and it puts those decisions in the hands of like the good guys, so to speak, the heroes. The new shows have done it too. You know, the, Discovery and Strange New Worlds have to erase the existence of Michael Burnham and Discovery in order to like keep this, like the fact that this AI decided to almost take over the Federation. And even that, like Spock is framed by it, by disinformation created by an AI. Mm-hmm. They make it look like Spock murdered people with holograms. And so then everybody thinks Spock is a murderer. But then they're like, oh, no, this was actually disinformation. This was, you know, so that they do it on the new shows. Even in Star Trek Picard, there's elements of that the Romulans have sort of created like this fake propaganda about like the dangers of AI. Right. And that they actually even create the invasion. Right. The attack on Mars is real, of course, but it's predicated on the premise that these androids are dangerous, which they're not, you know, but like, mm-hmm. Star Trek Enterprise, they had propaganda about whether or not humans and aliens could make babies. And then because these xenophobes were against it. And so then they wanted to, you know, create, sort of disinformation about that. So I don't know. There's a lot of that, actually. I haven't really thought about it before, but once you got me going.
Yeah. This is great. So speaking of the new franchises, your book came out just as Strange New Worlds, the latest Star Trek sub-franchise, made its debut on Paramount Plus. In the book, you say that Strange New Worlds could play the same breakout role in the 21st century that Star Trek The Next Generation played in the 80s and 90s. Now that the show is in progress, can you give us an update? How's it working out?
I think so. Yeah, I think that the strength of Strange New Worlds to me is that the ensemble of the characters feels immediately familiar. And I love the characters on Discovery and on Picard, but it took a while, even just the way those stories were written, for those ensembles to sort of coalesce, for us to know who all the characters were. I mean, you don't even meet all the major characters in Discovery until like the third and fourth episode. With Strange New Worlds, they kind of hit the ground running and say, hey, this is the crew, here's who they are, here's how they interact. And I think that sense of an ensemble of a kind of space family that you kind of instantly understand and know is part of what creates like this very nice platform to tell all these other stories. And so I think Strange New Worlds has done a very good job at doing that very quickly. I don't think that every episode of the season has been perfect, or not every episode has been my favorite, but I think that overall it still has that potential. And I think that because there's also just a lot of diversity in the types of characters you have there. And they've been putting those characters in a lot of interesting situations. And my favorite thing that they've done is they've created a few nice audience surrogates. If you've never watched Star Trek, you've got an audience surrogate in La'an, played by Christina Chong, which I think is interesting. And she's a really interesting character and is a new character for Star Trek, but she's also related distantly to Khan, which is cool. And then I think that Celia Rose Gooding, who plays the young Uhura, is also a nice audience surrogate. Because in the second episode, it's sort of like you're seeing the Enterprise crew through her experience. You know, she's brought to Captain Pike's table for dinner. And like, what's that like? You know, if you've been sleeping on Star Trek for a while, I think you watch the first episode of that show and you're not necessarily confused. You kind of get it instantly. And I think that's its strength. But yeah, there's exciting things still coming on Strange New Worlds. So I'm excited. I mean, there's things, no one expected a lot of the things that they've done on the show, right? Like to expand Spock's relationship with his fiance to Pring, to sort of show us the kinds of like sort of science acrobatics that Dr. Mbenga is having to perform to sort of save the ship. They did a pandemic, episode with the light pandemic in the Ghosts of Illyria. And I thought that was a really wonderful episode.
I'm curious to know your thoughts on Star Trek Prodigy, which is the new animated series for children.
Yeah, I didn't get a ton of Prodigy into the book just because some of that press was happening right when I was having to turn in final pages. And I was able to cheat a little bit with Strange New Worlds because I interviewed so much of the cast when they were still in Discovery. And I kind of had some sense of where that was headed. So I love Prodigy. Prodigy is interesting because it also is kind of inverted like how we think about Star Trek. It starts, you know, in this place that's not very optimistic. All these sort of tweens are on this mining facility. And so I think it has a lot to say, interestingly, about like plundering of natural resources and like how that sort of economy is bad and how in the Federation, they don't have as much of that. So the kids want to get to the Federation, right? Because they're not going to have to deal with this kind of bad socioeconomic situation. But yeah, I like Prodigy. I think that I was a little bit rattled by how different it was at first. And then as it got going, it just really endeared itself to me. And I really like the character of Rock Talk, who's the big sort of rock alien. I like how heroic she is, which is why I quoted from that actress, that young actress in the book, because of like how heroic and friendly and like what a great Star Trek character that character is. But yeah, I love Prodigy, and the writers of Prodigy are super nice. They're very friendly. I've interviewed a lot of them subsequent for articles online, and they're always like very like effusive and like responsive.
Yeah, I tuned in because I wanted to see the Janeway hologram. I love Captain Janeway, and I really like that chapter in the book about how Star Trek Voyager is enjoying kind of a rediscovery. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Voyager is interesting because it was sandwiched in between all these other famous Star Trek shows. It was well regarded, but its ratings, you know, weren't as high as The Next Generation, right, at the height of its popularity. But something interesting happened with Voyager in the streaming era in that it became extremely popular. And I think a lot of that has to do with the characters. I think that the characters are really compelling. Seven of Nine is really compelling. Tuvok is really compelling. And I think that the sense that the crew was kind of isolated from the rest of the Star Trek continuity, it oddly made the show slightly more timeless, I think, than some of the other sort of shows from that era, because it's a self-contained sort of set of rules when they're in the Delta Quadrant. And so I think that some of that, and I think that that's what Kate Mulgrew said to me, and that's quoted in the book, about like, none of the shows quite stranded the crew quite like, and made the captain make decisions on their own. Like, Janeway has to make decisions that Kirk and Picard and Sisko don't quite have to make on a week-to-week basis. And so she kind of pointed that out to me when I interviewed her late in 2021 about how that is a big deal. Because then it feels almost like more the decisions that they make matter more. And even if it kind of like is still an episodic TV show, and even if, you know, Voyager should look a little dirtier and grimier than it does, or whatever, you know, whatever your complaints are about just how beaten down is Voyager after all this time of not getting, you know, to go to the Starfleet car wash or whatever, but I think that it's that sense of self-reliance and isolation that all the characters sort of had that I think, and then it's a very upbeat show, right? It's not a dark show. And so the fact that all of that is happening, but then it's a very upbeat and buoyant show, I think is kind of a perfect cocktail for why people keep going back to it. And also, I think there's just some, there's some standout episodes that are just interesting science fiction concepts. You know, there's that episode, I always have to get this right. There's an original series episode called Wink of an Eye, and there's a Voyager episode called Blink of an Eye. And in Blink of an Eye, time moves at a different rate on this planet that Voyager rolls up on, right? And so then the time is, so the second they're there, they've already insinuated themselves into the history of this planet because they've been a star in the night sky because of the rate at which the time is moving. So relativity works differently or whatever. That's a really cool idea, right? So Captain Janeway, just by arriving, they violated the Prime Directive just by being there because they've already changed the course because they've become a constellation that would, or a star that wouldn't have otherwise existed. And I love that. I think that that's just like a delicious, and Voyager's got a lot of those that are just like really cool, where you're like even like silly ones, like where the doctor is like in Seven of Nine's body or whatever. Like even episodes like that, body and soul, like that's a great one. You know, the one where the doctor's holographic, another fake news one, where the doctor's hologram is projected 700 years in the future. Living Witness is the name of the episode. And there's this holographic recreation of a historical event about Voyager visiting this planet, and it's all wrong. They're warlords and they're terrible. So then this living hologram backup of the doctor is like, no, this is not how it happened. And so it's like benevolent technology fighting fake news technology, which is really it's fun to think about. It's like a Twilight Zone episode. That episode is wonderful.
Yeah, that one's really good. I wonder, you mentioned some classic Voyager episodes. What are your favorite episodes of the other series?
Sure. I mean, I'm a big Next Generation fan. So, you know, I love a Tapestry of the Next Generation, where Q shows Picard what his life would have been like had he avoided this bar fight when he was a young man. I love that. I love The Inner Light, obviously, where Picard lives an entire lifetime in the span of 30 minutes. And I'm very good friends with Morgan Gendel, who wrote that episode. I've become lifelong friends with him. He's a wonderful guy. We get on the phone and talk about everything, the Beatles, Star Trek, Star Wars, James Bond. I love Morgan and I love his writing. That episode is really a wonderful, wonderful one for a reason. So in Deep Space Nine, I really like Past Tense, where they go back to, where they get stuck back in time and Sisko has to impersonate the civil rights leader in the Bell riots. I think that's a really interesting, I remember that really like shaking me as a child, like, or not, I would have been a tween, I guess, when that came out, thinking that was just amazing. Even like really early Deep Space Nine episodes, like the episode that's just titled Dax is really good, where they're kind of like, can we put Jadzia on trial for something that one of her previous hosts did? And that episode was written by DC Fontana, who wrote for the original Star Trek. And I think that episode still holds up. It's like, for some reason, those courtroom Star Trek episodes are amazing, like Measure of a Man from the Next Generation, where they have to defend Data's sentience. And then in Voyager, they've got one called Author, where they have to decide whether or not the holographic doctor has rights as an artist to control his art as an artificial life form. I thought that was, in Tuvok's sort of his defender. I love that. And I love Enterprise. There's an episode of Enterprise called Impulse, which is like some Vulcan zombies. And it's, but it's also connected to like this like sort of emerging addiction that T'Pol has. That's really good. That was also written by Terry Metalis, who's the contemporary showrunner for Star Trek Picard season 2 and 3. And he's a really interesting writer. So that's a good one. There's a lot of Enterprise episodes. I really love the two episodes that sort of end Enterprise before the actual finale, which are Terra Prime and Demons, which is the two-part episode where that xenophobic group led by Peter Weller, formerly RoboCop and Buckaroo Banzai, and later plays a very similar villain in Star Trek Into Darkness, doing almost exactly the same thing. it was very odd. He leads this sort of xenophobic group that's sort of pushing aliens away from Earth, and Archer and Trip and everybody have to kind of stop him. And I love that two-parter. There's like cool references to Carl Sagan in there. There's like a heist. There's like a fight on Mars. That's a great, great episode. The new shows, Discovery, I love Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, which is a season one episode where Harry Mudd creates a time loop on the ship and they have to escape from the time loop. And Rainn Wilson, who plays Harry Mudd, I've interviewed a few times, is really cool. He's really great in that episode. I also really love the Discovery season 3 opener, where Burnham flies into the future and meets Book for the first time. And I like that one, which is just called That Hope Is You, Part One. And I love that episode because I like that in the end, you find out that Book is not smuggling an animal for profit, but to save it. And that's such a Star Trek twist to be like, this like crazy transworm monster is actually good. And so I love it when they do that in the newer shows. Of Picard, I really love the episode in season one where they go to the planet and they find Elnor, who is the Romulan warrior, and they meet the Kuat Malat, the warrior nuns, and the whole episode is framed with Picard telling the story of the Three Musketeers to Elnor as a young child. And then you sort of like, oh, Absolute Candor, that's the name of the episode, of course, because then you find out what absolute candor is. And it's this like ultimate truth that these Romulan nuns have. And I think that episode's just dynamite. And then it ends with this old school Romulan bird of prey from the original series that's been reappropriated by a warlord, and they have to fight it off. And then Seven of Nine beams on. That's such a great episode. And then of Strange New Worlds, my favorite episode of Strange New World is Spock Amok, where he and T'Pring switch bodies. I don't know if you've seen it. It just came out a few weeks ago. It's great. Lower Decks, I love the season one finale, which is called No Small Parts. And I love just what it has to say about like someone's status as like this lower class officer and then like sort of what that means. And then in Prodigy, they're kind of all one episode in my mind, but I do love Kobayashi, which is the one where Dal runs the holographic simulation and he gets to interact with Spock and Uhura and Scotty. I mean, you got to love that.
I don't think you mentioned a favorite show from the original series and also the movies. I don't know. Do you have a favorite Star Trek movie?
Well, I'll answer the original series question first. My favorite episode of the original series is probably A Taste of Armageddon, which is the one where they go to the planet where the war is being fought by computers.
That one for sure. Yeah.
I just think that episode encapsulates so much of what the original series is good at, which is just that it has this perfect balance between bad technology, good technology, and like the way people are using it. And that Kirk doesn't accept the premise that war is a constant, but then he uses this great irony to demonstrate to them, you know, I'll show you how much of a barbarian I can be, you know, and like all this stuff. And that quote, as you probably know, is used in For All Mankind. The, we can resist the urge. I won't kill today, you know, and all of that kind of like that big stirring stuff where it's like, we are flawed, but we can do better. And that's really present in that episode. It's also such a great concept if you've never seen it before, where they're just like, oh, we just report to our incineration booths, you know, and Kirk and Spock right. are like, this is nuts. You know, we're not going to stand for this. But, you know, that you can kind of see where this culture is coming from. And that's and you're kind of like, ooh, that's creepy. It's like very Black Mirror in that way. Right. You could imagine right. like a Black Mirror version of that episode. So that's my favorite episode of the original series. But I also love all of it. I love Shore Leave. I love the Doomsday Machine. I love Amok Time. I love the menagerie. Spock puts his life on the line for Captain Pike, who cannot communicate, cannot stand up for himself. So Spock stands up for him. And I think that's just delicious and wonderful. And in other films, you know, I mean, it's got to be The Wrath of Khan. I have had a long correspondence with Nicholas Meyer, who directed The Wrath of Khan and co-wrote the scripts, cobbled together from like five different scripts. And I love the literary weight of The Wrath of Khan. You know, it opens with Spock and Kirk talking about Dickens. It ends with Dickens. Moby Dick is in the middle. I love how it made me feel when I was a young person. I love how it makes me feel now. I love the science angles of it, that the Genesis device is this double-edged sword, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like Bones is like, you know, Spock says it's always been easier to destroy than create. And Bones is like, not anymore, you know, and then they have this whole discussion about how it can create life, but it also overwrites it. And it's very simplistic, but it feels like a really classic original series ethical dilemma. And it makes sense that Khan would want to like take that and use it for nefarious reasons. And it also makes sense that like Kirk's one true love, like Carol Marcus, invented it to like help, you know, and she's a civilian, right? Like she's not part of Starfleet. And she's just like, this is going to be used to like help people colonize space. And that's going to be positive. But then the whole conflict is sort of like the struggle for like how that tech is used. It's just a wonderful film. You can show it to anybody and they don't need to know who Khan is or Kirk is. Mm-hmm. And they just get it. yeah, and just the acting at every single scene is just great. And yeah, but you know, The Voyage Home, a close second.
Sure.
And yeah. And then First Contact, you know, the first Next Generation film, because it's just like, I'll never forget when the Vulcans stepped out of the ship and, you know, did Live Long and Prosper, and it was like a contemporary setting. I thought that was so, I think that's what you always want, right? Like the idea that the Star Trek world could step into a contemporary setting. That's always really exciting.
From the way that this conversation has gone, people might think that, man, this guy is totally 100% Star Trek, but you write about Star Wars and other science fiction sagas. So what's your take on, for example, Star Trek versus Star Wars fan culture?
Well, I think that there's a lot of overlap, obviously, you know, and I think that, as I say in the book, Star Trek fan culture helped to sort of like mainstream science fiction, which George Lucas sort of noticed and mentioned. He says, you know, that it loosened up the culture so Star Wars could stand on its shoulders. So Star Trek is like a priori to Star Wars, right? Like you need it to happen. And the original series has a lot in common with Star Wars in a way, you know, in the way that Kirk's goals are different than Han Solo's goals. And that's because of the status quo, right? Kirk lives in a universe where he can kind of look out for other people. Han Solo lives in a universe where he can't. And so he's looking out for himself. But, you know, there's a lot in common there, just to the way that the kind of cowboy kind of nature in which those stories are told. So I think that they have more in common in the way their stories are told than people are willing to admit. Star Wars only tells a few different kinds of stories, though, right? Like it only has redemption arcs, and it has these big, you know, political struggles, whereas Star Trek can, you know, they can do a episode that's just a whodunit, or they can do a comedy, or they, you know, it has a lot more to play with. But I don't want to say anything bad about Star Wars fans, because you know, for every bad apple you find in Star Wars fans, you could find a bad apple among Star Trek fans too. But I do think, though, that if you're only a Star Wars fan, this is the primary difference. Star Wars has always been popular. Star Wars was always popular. It was never not popular. It was a hit right away. It was never weird to like Star Wars. Whereas Star Trek is not that way, right? Like it has gone through periods of where it was, you know, it was something that literally the fans created conventions for a media product that was not being sold to them. Right? Like they demanded that Star Trek come back. Whereas like Star Wars was sold to those fans. They did that research. Charles Lippincott was this publicist who worked on Star Wars, and you know, he marketed Star Wars to the fan conventions of the day. He knew that you had to go to where those fans were and market a film like that. Now, by 1976, a lot of that culture was created by Star Trek conventions, right? A lot of the excitement around those conventions was created by Star Trek conventions. So the core audience for Star Wars arguably was Star Trek fans. You know, and people would argue, oh, well, real Star Trek fans didn't like it because it wasn't a very scientific film. And it's like, right. But most people saw the sort of value in both. You know what I mean? And I think that Star Wars just comes from a status quo where it wasn't trying to do stories about the future. It literally is not set in the future. Lucas didn't feel like he had a responsibility to tell sort of like specifically political stories about specific things. Granted, there are a lot of politics in Star Wars, though. You know, it's an anti-fascist narrative. I mean, nobody thinks that the Empire is good, you know, but if Star Wars was done as like a Star Trek style show, you would probably have more episodes where you'd be finding more bad things about the rebellion and more good things about the Empire. You know what I mean? There would probably be a lot more moral conundrums. But, you know, Mark Hamill is a big Star Trek fan, and Rod Roddenberry is a big Star Wars fan, who's the son of Gene Roddenberry. And, you know, Anson Mount, who plays Captain Pike on Strange New Worlds, you know, was recently just like, you know, coming out in defense of Moses Ingram, the actress from Obi-Wan Kenobi, and saying like, the Star Trek family's got the Star Wars family's back. You know what I mean? I thought that was great. I'm get to talk to Anson in a couple weeks. So I'm excited to talk to him about that. But yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of crossover there.
And also, I understand that your next book is going to be about the Dune saga and its impact. And so I'm wondering whether there are different impacts that specific science fiction sagas have on society, because Dune has been cast as kind of an environmental allegory.
Yeah. So what I feel like the Star Trek book, Phasers Unstunned, that we're talking about, I feel like is about radical change, right? About how fiction and narrative art can like change itself radically, but also like affect change on real life. The Dune book is more about paradoxes and contradictions, because Dune is a hero's journey that's not a hero's journey. It is an adventure book that's not an adventure book. It's a book about ecology and science, in which the scientists and ecologists are not major characters. And I just finished some of the early pages of it, and I was talking to John Harrison, who directed the 2000 Dune, on the Sci-Fi Channel, the one with William Hurt. And it's the most popular, supposedly unpopular thing ever, right? It's both underground and mainstream at the same time. And that's very different than Star Trek and Star Wars, right? Like Star Wars is like Coke, you know, Star Trek is like Pepsi, Dune is like, you know,
Dr. Pepper.
Or a bootleg alcohol that you have to get at a, you know, a specific back room or something. You know, it has a lot of contradictions in it. And I think it's, I think that's really interesting. And also what I'm doing with the Dune book is the opposite of the Star Trek book in a sense, because with the Star Trek book, I was doing something that people had done before, which is to tell the story of the behind the scenes of Star Trek. But I was doing it in a new way. And then I was also catching up with the new shows, which most of those other books had not done. Nobody's done what I'm doing with the Dune book, which is to try to unite the 1963 stories that were published in Analog by John Campbell that then became the novel in 1965, and then have that lead to the other novels and the different films and more books. And like, so no one's done that. And so that's scary. Mm-hmm. It's very scary, but I'm working on it now. It's supposed to come out next year.
Do you see any new science fiction franchises out there that could have the staying power or the opportunities for reinvention that we've seen with Star Trek?
Maybe really good.
The Expanse. The Expanse is based on a limited series of books, so I'm not sure how much opportunity there is for reinvention or spinoffs.
There's a lot of, you know, obviously there's a lot of Star Trek talent involved with the Expanse shows. Naren Shankar, who's the showrunner, was a technical advisor on The Next Generation. And so the Expanse definitely has it. I don't know, to be honest with you, I think For All Mankind is the best science fiction show on TV right now. And I think the reason it has potential is because the season they're in now is set in this alternate 1990s. But Ron Moore told me when season two ended that the plan is to do 7 seasons, and that each time they jump 10 or so or more years into the future. So that means by like season 5, they could be like in an alternate version of now. And by the show ends, it could be in the future, and you won't have any of the same characters that they have now. None. They'll have none of the same characters. And so they've described that as 100 years of solitude for science fiction, which has never really been done. And I think that that means that aspects of the show can kind of fail and maybe not work, and that they can still sort of like trudge ahead and say, okay, well, now we're in the year 2001, but it's from this science fiction point of view. And so now we have a colony on Mars. And like, what does that mean? I don't know. I've never seen a science fiction show quite like that. Like Babylon 5 kind of did a little bit of that in the 90s, like where they would like project like a few of those episodes would say, okay, here's what happens a million years from now. But the fact that For All Mankind starts in an alternate 1969 and could potentially end in an alternate like 2050. I've never seen that in a science fiction show. So I don't know if it has the quite like, it's an adult drama about adult things. So I don't know if it has quite the ability to have, like Foundation may even have more. The Foundation series that's on Apple now may have more of like a casual fan appeal. I know people love The Expanse and I like The Expanse too, but I think that story does kind of end,
yeah.
You know? So I think it's tough, but yeah, I mean, I guess it could get bigger. I think that Doctor Who is still out there, you know, and Doctor Who is, you know, still good. And a lot of the 21st century stuff that is happening is definitely owed to Doctor Who. You know what I mean? When I first started writing about science fiction, there was no new Star Trek TV show coming out. There was no new Star Wars movies coming out. You know, none of that was happening. It was just Battlestar Galactica had ended and Doctor Who was on. And so I think that yeah, I wouldn't discount Doctor Who, I guess is what I'm saying, is that it's the closest thing to Star Trek in that it's very upbeat.
Okay, well, besides all the things we've mentioned, are you reading or watching or listening to anything interesting?
I just watched that Spiderhead movie on Netflix, which was based on a George Saunders short story, which is a science fiction sort of horror.
I read the story. I didn't know it was a movie. The story's horrific.
Yeah, so they just made it into a kind of a feature-length Black Mirror-style film. And I thought that that was very arresting and really compelling in a way that I didn't expect it to be. And I love George Saunders' stories, so I thought that was really great. I'm watching the new season of Westworld that's not out yet, which is okay. I like it better than some of the previous seasons. I'm doing a lot of research for the Dune book, unfortunately. So a lot of my reading time is sucked up by that. And so I'm reading also a lot of older science fiction books from that period as well. So like Bill Ransom wrote these sort of books about clones with Frank Herbert called The Pandora Sequence. So I'm reading all of those, and that's really fun. Listening to anything, my wife and I are obsessed with Japanese Breakfast, the band. We're going to go see her in a month with the National. So I'm excited about that.
That's going to be a good show.
Yeah, I'm really excited. So that's exciting. I always try to sort of retreat from science fiction when it's like late at night. So I've been reading a lot of Julian Barnes lately, who I love. My wife got me a bunch of Julian Barnes books for Father's Day. There is one thing that I'm forgetting, you know what was really good that people didn't talk about that is a science fiction film was I'm Your Man. The movie, it was a German movie with Dan Stevens, who was in Downton Abbey. That was a movie about this woman who gets a robot, like sort of as a lover. She's like beta testing a robot as a lover. And it's great. I'm Your Man. That was like a really underrated movie. Oh, I'm watching The Man Who Fell to Earth on Showtime, which is produced by Alex Kurtzman and Kate Mulgrew is in it. And that's really excellent. And I interviewed Chiwetel Ejiofor for that show, The Man Who Fell to Earth. That's a really underrated show. That's a sequel to the David Bowie film. I actually just have an interview I did with Kate Mulgrew about that I have to transcribe tomorrow. So yeah, The Man Who Fell to Earth is really good. You definitely like an under the radar sci-fi show about aliens among us and technology. He creates a tech company. Are you watching it?
No, that's one that I have missed. Although our previous guest on Fiction Science Podcast, Tim Barnes, recommended The Man Who Fell to Earth as well. So I guess I'm slowly getting the message that I better put that on my watch list.
Yeah, it's definitely like I would describe it as, because it's written and directed by Alex Kurtzman and Jenny Lumet, who's one of his collaborators in the new Trek show. So you can kind of see the influence of the new Star Trek shows on it. But it's almost like that sort of combined with like Arrival, the Denis Villeneuve film that Amy Adams is in.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, I feel like The Man Who Fell to Earth is like a rival, but with the sensibility of the newer Star Trek shows, but very brutal and real. And Chiwetel Ejiofor, who is this, of course, this actor that everybody loves, he really brings something. I've never seen anybody play an alien like that. It's cool, though. It's a cool show. I wish it wasn't on Showtime. I wish it was streaming on something else. Because I feel like it's getting a little bit overlooked because of that. You know, and I'm watching Obi-Wan Kenobi like everybody else. You know, I interviewed Hayden Christensen last week for Obi-Wan Kenobi. And, I'm going to be up at 3 a.m. tomorrow watching the Obi-Wan Kenobi finale. You know, so I'm watching that.
Well, we've been talking about decades of science fiction here. And so let's project into the future. What place do you think that Star Trek will fill in the cultural milieu of, say, 2066, 100 years after the original series had its premiere?
Wow, that's a great question. I have thought about this, about like how old will I be when Star Trek has its 100th anniversary? And like, what will that be like? Like, how will my five-year-old perceive Star Trek in 45 years? Yeah, I'll be 85, 86, you know? So it's reasonable to assume that it'll still be around in some form. Assuming that the mediums stay relatively the same, which I think they probably will, I don't see like the medium of TV going away. It might be watched in a different way. But I mean, we've had screens and cameras for a while now.
Yeah.
I don't see that like turning into like direct to telepathy TV in like 40 years. I don't know why. So I think that it will have to do a couple more radical reinventions though to stay relevant. And I think that some of that might be a true reboot, right? Where you just completely throw it all out and you just start over and you say, we'll do Starfleet, the Prime Directive, and the Enterprise, but that's all. And then everything else can be reinvented. And the Enterprise can look like, you know, a contemporary NASA rocket or something like that. And, you know, they could be doing it in that way. Or they could do something where they go even further in the future than they are in Discovery now. And they go to some kind of like post-singularity future that's like, you know, the year 40,000. And there's like one human left or something. You know, I think they could do something like that. That would be really, really radical. They're going to need to get radical again. But by, I say they, which I'm implying a collective group of the same people, it will be people that are completely different. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be people that haven't even been interested in Star Trek until next year. And that person could be running it in 20 years, you know, whoever that person is, we don't know who they are. That's the interesting thing, I think, is that whoever is the sort of keeper of it right now, it's Alex Kurtzman and some of his collaborators, Michelle Paradise, who's the showrunner of Star Trek Discovery. Those are some of the folks that are sort of doing this amazing job of being the caretakers of Star Trek. But yeah, I mean, who will those people be in 20 years, 30? I don't know.
I have a feeling that you're still going to be following the Star Trek saga in 2066. So we're going to have to stay tuned for the next chapter from Ryan Britt.
Yeah, stay tuned. I hope to do a paperback of this eventually because I'm going to have to include all these new shows.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us, Brian, and good luck with Phasers on Stun and all the other adventures that are coming up.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Check out my blog item on cosmiclog.com for more about Star Trek and about Ryan Britt's book, Phasers on Stun. You'll also find links to some classic stories about Star Trek science and technology, including a rare Q&A with Starship Enterprise Captain William Shatner from the very first year of Cosmic Log's existence, 20 years ago. While you're online, check out DominicaFetaPlace.com. Don't worry about the spelling, just follow the link from the Cosmic Log item. Thanks to Ryan Britt and Penguin Random House for the interview, and thanks to James Emley for his rendition of the fiction science theme music, composed by yours truly. Please subscribe to our fiction science podcast and feel free to give us a stellar rating on your favorite podcast channel. And so, until next time, this is Alan Boyle advising you to watch the skies.